For 2 years now, I've been able and happy to say I'm pleased. My name's Bob Hughes. And I'm pleased and privileged and proud to be the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Frederick. I keep reminding you of who you are, a unique congregation of people so bold as to proclaim that we stand on the side of love as we gather Sunday after Sunday to build community and further justice and open to mystery. We're a congregation when you can expect to be accepted as you are and be challenged and nurtured and sustained to become who you can be. I would also remind you of the question and answer event next Sunday with Mike Morris after the service. And we have a special event today, the observance, the commissioning of C. Raven and Deb Calhoun. There you are, behind C. Raven, yeah, as lay ministers. So that'll be after the offertory. Well, when you hear the name Clara Barton, what do you think of? Anything besides American Red Cross?
Driving home.
Driving home. Yeah, Clara Barton Parkway. You know, I grew up with the Mosby Highway, the Lee Jackson Highway. It's nice to hear a highway name for somebody like Clara Barton, who played a part in that same war, very different part, who ministered to wounded on both sides, actually. That's something else maybe you didn't know. Anything else you think of besides American Red Cross and Clara Barton Parkway?
Not a little. I just read her book.
Oh, you read her book because she wanted to be a nurse. Yeah, she wrote about that. And okay, anything else? Okay. Laura, I told you some good information about Miss Barton. We have one of our classrooms named the Clara Barton Room, the one just outside the chapel. It's 125 is the other name for it. The Clara Barton Room. Seems to me it would be good for many reasons for us to know a little bit more about Clara Barton. Because our classrooms are named and because we're a Unitarian Universalist congregation, you might assume that Clara Barton had something to do with Unitarian Universalism, and that would be correct. Actually, it was Universalism in those days. It was before the merger. I wonder how all the rooms got named. Knowing you folks, I bet that was some kind of process. I don't want to know. Okay. Deciding on the names. Why did you leave out Priestley? What about Emerson? We don't have an Emerson room. You know, I can imagine that was quite a process. So, with Clara Barton, you done good. Well, she was born on Christmas Day, 1821. 1820. Florence Nightingale had been born the year before, so they were contemporaries. I don't know that they ever met. I couldn't find the record of their meeting, but they were both in Europe at the same time. 1821. She was from Oxford, Massachusetts. Her family was a part of the Universalist congregation there. Her dad was a veteran. Her mother was a homemaker. The family was very active in that particular congregation. It was the same congregation Hosea Ballou spoke the dedication service for. I'm becoming aware. I've just got today and one more Sunday to talk with you. I haven't talked about Hosea Ballou. There's so much I'd like to say that I won't have time for. But 1821, think, United States, 1821. What was the role of women in those days? Women couldn't vote. The many occupations were closed to them. Their role in society was pretty well determined. But among the Universalists, there were some exceptions. That Universalist background is going to help you know something about and appreciate Clara Barton. She's the youngest of five children, two older brothers, two older sisters. She was the much beloved baby of the family. And as Laura said, she did learn how to ride bareback, read, write, do arithmetic, and as it happened, attend the Universalist congregation. Drove 5 miles every Sunday to go to the Universalist church. I'll say something about her faith a little later. That was a big part of her life. When her family was not with her, Clara Barton was a shy young woman. Very shy. that worried her parents. They wanted to help her be more outgoing, so they sent her away to school when she was 9 years old, to boarding school. But she got homesick. She didn't like it. She was so shy and homesick. She begged to come home, so they let her come home. And when she was 11, was when her brother fell, older brother fell from the roof of the barn and was just really hurt badly. The doctor said he may die. Clara begged for the chance to take care of him and to nurse him. So that's what she did for 2 years, every day, to sit with him. She stopped going to school so she would be able to take care of her brother. She then, when she was 17, as Laura mentioned, took her first job of teaching. And now, here's a shy person. She was intentional about that. I'll take this job of teaching to help me overcome my shyness. How intentional can we be about the growth that we want to have? And the boys did have a deep respect for her. She could throw as hard and run as fast as they could. A few years later, a friend in New Jersey asked her to come and start a public school there. Now, most schools in those days were private. You had to pay to go. And a public school was suspect in those days. People thought that's not a good idea to teach these riffraff how to read and write and stuff. But she went, and she said, "Oh, first 3 months, I won't charge you anything. Teach." Started the school with 6 children on the first day. It grew to 600 kids. The town gave her an old school building to work with. And then they said, "We need to build a new school for all these children here." So, great. "Oh, we need to hire a principal." She applied. They said no. She said no. Clara Barton had an emphasis on fairness. She resigned. If they hired a man to do what she had been doing and were going to pay her half to be a female assistant. And she said, "No, that's not fair." Here's a quote. "I may sometimes be willing to teach for nothing, but if paid at all, I shall never do a man's work for less than a man's pay." Now that's pretty spunky for a woman in the 1840s. Huh? So she moved to Washington, D.C. She took a job in the patent office. Started as a clerk, and some other things happened in there, but I want to get to the Civil War. 1861. War between the states. Before I grew up, it had other names, but we won't go into that. You recall our country wasn't ready for such a war. The capital of the United States was Washington. It was only 80 miles from the capital of the Confederacy. Northern Virginia was a Confederate stronghold with Mosby and Jackson and all those folks. Civil War, in many ways, just kind of landed on her doorstep. Early on, there were some soldiers from Massachusetts, many of them, who had been ambushed in Baltimore and were on the train, lost all their luggage and all their gear, and some of them were hurt pretty badly. On the train back to Washington, she greeted them and saw their plight and took a bunch of them home with her and to her sister's house to help them, and started going around gathering up materials and supplies from merchants. And many of the soldiers coming back home were in that kind of, coming back wounded, were in that kind of situation. Supplies, the federal government wasn't ready to deal with all the people who were wounded. So she took it on herself to gather materials and started raising money for that herself, used some of her own money. And then she got the news that even on the battlefield there weren't enough supplies. So she said, "I gotta go." Army said no. She said yes. And she finally got permission. She did what no woman had done before. Women weren't allowed on the battlefield. That was man's kind of stuff. But she got a wagon load of supplies, arrived in Culpeper, Virginia at midnight. The Army doctor was so exhausted that he turned things over to her. She went to work cooking and taking care of the wounded right away. She even learned how to take bullets out with a penknife on occasion. You know, now her only training so far had been helping her brother. She one time said, "I wasn't a nurse. I just took supplies and did what needed to be done." But that army surgeon said, and here's a quote from him, "If heaven ever sent out a holy angel, she must be the one." And after that, she was known as the angel of the battlefield. 14 different battles. And these were intense things. And she was not just back behind the lines. She took care of wounded soldiers, both Confederate and Union. Why? She nursed anybody who needed help. And I'm convinced that was partly because of her Universalist heritage. Every life is precious. Every life is precious. She said, "I have no enemies." To show you how dramatic things got, one time she was kneeling beside a wounded soldier to give some water. A bullet came through the sleeve of her dress. Didn't hit her, but it hit the soldier and killed him. Another time, she had to get away quickly. She jumped on a horse. You've seen the movies, the Western movies, about people riding along and then getting on a train? She did that. Now, the train wasn't at full speed, but here she is in the clothes she wore in those days, riding the horse to get on the train that was already moving to get away. Years later, she said, "People call me a nurse. I scarcely know why. There were no nurses then. My work was mostly to get timely supplies to those in need." She didn't take a salary during that whole time. No salary. In 1864, she did get an official title. She became the superintendent of Army nurses. And we need to note that there were other women involved with all of this too. There was Dorothea Dix. Remember that name? Frances Dana Barker Gage, Mary Livermore. What do you know about those folks? What was their big push? Suffrage. Women's suffrage. Yeah, suffragettes. It's an interesting term, isn't it? Suffragettes, you know. Well, I just can imagine that bunch of ladies was a bunch of feisty females. And if you ever want to get something done, you don't stand in the way. A bunch of feisty females. And remember, she's a shy person. She was a shy person. Well, the war ended. There were some 80,000 Union troops who couldn't be found, missing. And people would call or see Ms. Barton or write and say, "I can't find my brother or my husband. Can you help?" President Lincoln called her to the White House and said, "Is there something you could do?" And so he gave her a grant, actually, for some money to interview people, released prisoners from Confederate prisons, and would ask them about, "Do you know about Fred Jones or whoever it was who's missing?" And she compiled lists to help people get reunited with their families, or at least find out what happened to their loved ones. She set up an office, much of it her money. She wrote down what she found and kept that information for others. Well, soon the grant money from Lincoln and her money ran out, so she went to raise more. She's a spunky little something. She gave lectures about the war. She said, "I really don't want to do this, but I'll do what has to be done." Here's another quote. "I would rather stand on the battlefield than speak at a public meeting." But the crowds came, large crowds. Wherever she went, she was able to make enough money to keep her office going, to help people get reunited. So mentioned Dorothea Dix and company. There was another person who was greatly influential, Frederick Douglass. So she not only took on the cause of women's rights, but of Negro rights, as it was called in those days, too. She would go to a group of veterans, and she would say, here's another quote, "Soldiers, I have worked for you, and now I ask you, one and all, consider the wants of my people. God only knows women were your friend in time of peril. Now, you should be ours." This is the 1870s. Here's an excerpt from a letter she wrote to Frances Gage in 1870. "My dear Fanny, I can never see a poor mutilated wreck blown to pieces with powder and lead without wondering if visions of such an end ever flitted before his mother's mind when she washed and dressed her fair-skinned baby. Women should certainly have some voice in the matter of war, either affirmative or negative. And the fact that she has not this should not be made the ground on which to deprive her of other privileges. She can't say there should be no war, and she shan't take any part in it when there is one. And because she don't part and take part in war, she must not vote. And because she can't vote, she has no voice in her government. And because she has no voice in her government, she isn't a citizen. And because she isn't a citizen, she has no rights. And because she has no rights, she must submit to wrongs. And because she submits to wrongs, she isn't anybody. And what does she know about war? And because she doesn't know anything about it, she mustn't do or say anything about it. A powerful, powerful voice for fairness and equality. That universalist theme of fairness keeps coming up. Well, Clara Barton and company moved the nation along very slowly. When did women get to vote? 1920, 19th Amendment. And you know what? There were other states who didn't get around to ratifying it then. The last state which shall remain nameless was 1984. Before they ratified the 19th Amendment. But it became law in 1920. Tennessee was the deciding state to approve it. And that's a dramatic story too for another time. She was writing in the 1870s and speaking 50 years later. Women finally got to vote. You know, when we're tempted to think change happens slowly, you know, be aware that at least it's better than it was in many ways. She went on the lecture tour for 2 years and lost her voice. She really spent some time being ill. She wasn't a strong woman. She would get sick and have to take time out. This was one of those occasions. Her doctor said, "You need to rest. Go to Europe. You know, just get away for a while." So she went to Switzerland. But I guess she didn't rest too much. She discovered the International Red Cross. That was an organization started to help soldiers of any side in the battle. And things like the Geneva Convention was going, that various nations signed on, that they agreed that they would let combatants would not interfere with medical personnel to help the wounded. And that was the Geneva Convention. The United States didn't sign it until she got back. She discovered the International Red Cross. She came back and said, two things. We need to sign the Geneva Convention and we need to start an American Red Cross. And she talked and she lectured and she got it going. And her point was that you need the Red Cross not just for wartime sake, but to help in other times too, with floods and famines and difficulties and tornadoes. She explained that work to other countries. Foreign leaders decorated her. Our German emperor gave her the Iron Cross of Merit. She worked. She kept working. When she was 71, the Spanish-American War got going. She's 71. She goes to Cuba and riding on mule trains there to deliver goods to the troops. 77 years old. She was in Texas for the flood there. Johnstown flood, she was there. With the Red Cross, trying to help people with blankets or whatever they might need. She remained president of the American Red Cross until she was 83. And then it was only with some nudging of her friends that she retired again. Lived in Glen Echo, Maryland, where she died 8 years later in 1912 at the age of 91. Her body was returned to Oxford, Massachusetts, where she's buried. Well, I've come to appreciate Clara Barton a great deal more. I hope you'll walk down the hallway and look at some of the children's art. They were asked to draw something about Clara Barton. You'll see several red crosses as you go along there. I've got a couple things to show you as well. The fellow who owns the land to the north here, Dean Guernsey, came by one day. He happens to be the former curator of the Clara Barton Museum in Glen Echo. And he brought this by. It's a little corner piece from corner of a doorway in the Clara Barton home. And he said, "Now, could you use that?" I said, "Sure. I don't know how yet." But somehow that needs to be a part of the Clara Barton room. He brought a couple of pictures from the home there. He brought a piece of a banister. And again, I don't know what to do with this. But it came from Clara Barton's house. A little water damage on there. And something, a piano stool. This is from Clara Barton's home. So, things the museum didn't need. So put your thinking cap on and think about how we might use these to celebrate the life of Clara Barton. I wonder maybe, since Glen Echo is not that far away, if maybe the high school youth group ought to go down every year or two and see the museum and get a better sense of who this woman was and what she had to contribute to the American culture and to our movement, to the Universalist movement. What might we take away from the life of Universalist Clara Barton? A word I think of is service. In a few moments, we'll commission two of our members as lay ministers. They've chosen that particular role, style of statement of service. And we've heard something about Clara Barton, a life of service. I'm convinced it was Miss Barton's Universalist faith that helped sustain her. Here's a part of a letter she wrote. This was published in the Universalist Leader. She's writing to a friend. "My dear friend and sister, your belief that I am a Universalist is as correct as your greater belief that you are one yourself, a belief in which all who are privileged to possess it rejoice. In my case, it was a great gift. Like St. Paul, I was born free, and save the pain of reaching it through years of struggle and doubt. My father was a leader in the building of the church in which Hosea Ballou preached his first dedication sermon. Your historic records will show that the old Huguenot town of Oxford, Massachusetts, erected one of, if not the first, Universalist church in America. In this town I was born, in this church I was reared. In all its reconstructions and remodelings I have taken a part, and I look anxiously for a time in the near future when the busy world will let me once more become a living part of its people, praising God for the advance in the liberal faith of the religions of the world today, so largely due to the teachings of this belief. Give, I pray you, my dear sister, my warmest congratulations to the members of your society, my best wishes for the success of your annual meeting, and accept my thanks most sincerely for having written me. Fraternally yours, Clara Barton." Well, what about us? What about our faith and commitment? As a congregation, you've said it's important for us to have more outreach to the community outside our walls. You know what that means? I mean, somebody's got to go out there and do that. And you know who that is? That's you. And let's not have any excuses. I mean, if Clara Barton can go to Cuba at age 71 to help soldiers there, 83, she's still the president of the American Red Cross. That's not an excuse. And know that a full-time minister is not going to be able to serve all the needs of the larger community. He or she is going to need some help with that. I trust the next minister can inspire and challenge and encourage and empower you to take our Unitarian Universalist principles into the larger community. And there's still some service to be done in the congregation. Laura has a dickens of a time finding RE teachers and helpers. That's some service we could do within the congregation. Many possibilities. That's just one. You don't have to. You could be a helper or a teacher for a year or a block of time, or talk to Laura about that. Well, may the life of Clara Barton, Universalist, Angel of Mercy, servant to those in need, may her life inspire and encourage us in the days and years ahead.